Mine's out of you.
He'd reached out to grab her by the collar of her shirt, but she'd dodged him easily. He fumbled for her again. Out of the corner of her eye, Inej saw Jesper rise from his seat, but she waved him off and slipped her fingers into the brass knuckles she kept in her right hip pocket. She gave Rojak a swift crack across the left cheek. His hand flew up to his face.
Hey, he said. I didn't hurt you none. It was just words.
People were watching now, so she hit him again. Regardless of the Crow Club rules, this took precedence. When Kaz had brought her to the slat, he'd warned her that he wouldn't be able to watch out for her, that she'd have to fend for herself, and she had. It would have been easy enough to turn away when they called her names or sidled up to ask for a cuddle, but do that, and soon it was a hand up your blouse or a try at you against a wall. So she'd let no insult or innuendo slide. She'd always struck first and struck hard. Sometimes she even cut them up a bit. It was fatiguing, but nothing was sacred to the Kerch except trade, so she'd gone out of her way to make the risk much higher than the reward when it came to disrespecting her. Rojak touched his fingers to the ugly bruise forming on his cheek, looking surprised and a bit betrayed.
I thought we was friendly, he protested.
The sad part was that they were. Inej liked Rojak, but right now he was just a frightened man looking to feel bigger than someone.
Rojak, she'd said, I've seen you work a deck of cards. You can get a job in almost any den. Go home,
and be grateful Kaz doesn't take what you owe him out of your hide, hmm? He'd gone, a bit wobbly on his feet, still clutching his cheek like a stunned toddler. And Jesper had sauntered over.
He's right, you know. Kaz shouldn't send you to do his dirty work.
It's all dirty work.
But we do it just the same,
he said with a sigh.
You look exhausted. Will you sleep at all tonight?
Jesper just winked.
Not while the cards are hot. Stay and play a bit. Kaz will stake you.
Really, Jesper? She'd said, pulling up her hood. If I want to watch men dig holes to fall into, I'll find myself a cemetery.
Come on, Inej,
he'd called after her as she passed through the big double doors onto the street.
You're good luck.
Saints, she'd thought. If he believes that, he really must be desperate.
She'd left her luck behind in a Suli camp on the shores of Westrovka. She doubted she'd see either again. Now Inej left her tiny chamber in the slat and headed downstairs by way of the banisters. There was no reason to cloak her movements here, but silence was habit, and the stairs tended to squeak like mating mice. When she reached the second floor landing and saw the crowd milling below, she hung back. Kaz had been gone longer than anyone had expected, and as soon as he'd entered the shadowy foyer, he'd been waylaid by people looking to congratulate him on his routing of Giles and asking for news of the Black Tips.
Rumor has it Giles is already putting together a mob to move on us, said Annika.
Let him,
rumbled Derex.
I've got an axe handle with his name on it.
Giles won't act for a while, said Kaz as he moved down the hall. He doesn't have the numbers to face us in the streets, and his coffers are too empty to hire on more hands. Shouldn't you be on your way to the Crow Club?
The raised eyebrow was enough to send Annika scurrying away, Derex on her heels. Others came to offer congratulations or make threats against the Black Tips.
No one went so far as to pat Kaz on the back, though. That was a good way to lose a hand.
Inej knew Kaz would stop to speak to Per Haskell. So instead of descending the final flight of stairs, she moved down the hallway. There was a closet here full of odds and ends, old chairs with broken backs, paint-splattered canvas sheeting. Inej moved aside a bucket full of cleaning supplies that she'd placed there precisely because she knew no one in the slat would ever touch it. The grate beneath it offered a perfect view of Per Haskell's office. She felt slightly guilty for eavesdropping on Kaz, but he was the one who had turned her into a spy. You couldn't train a falcon, then expect it not to hunt. Through the grate, she heard Kaz's knock on Per Haskell's door and the sound of his greeting.
Back and still breathing,
the old man inquired. She could see him seated in his favorite chair, fiddling with a model ship he'd been building for the better part of a year, a pint of lager within arm's reach, as always.
We won't have a problem with the Fifth Harbor again.
Haskell grunted and returned to his model ship.
Close the door.
Inej heard it shut, muffling the sounds from the hallway. She could see the top of Kaz's head. His dark hair was damp. It must have started raining.
You should have gotten permission from me to deal with Bolliger, said Haskell. If I had talked to you first, word might have gotten out. You think I'd let that happen?
Kaz's shoulders lifted.
This place is like anything in Ketterdam. It leaks.
Inej could have sworn he looked directly at the vent when he said it.
I don't like it, boy. Big Bolliger was my soldier, not yours.
Of course, Kaz said. But they both knew it was a lie. Haskell's dregs were old guard, con men and crooks from another time. Bolliger had been one of Kaz's crew, new blood, young and unafraid. Maybe too unafraid.
You're smart, Brecker, but you need to learn patience. Yes, sir.
The old man barked a laugh.
Yes, sir. No, sir, he mocked. I know you're up to something when you start getting polite. Just what have you got brewing? A job, Kaz said. I may need to be gone for a spell. Big money? Very. Big risk? That too. But you'll get your 20%. You don't make any major moves without my say-so. Understood?
Kaz must have nodded because Per Haskell leaned back in his chair and took a sip of lager.
Are we going to be very rich? Rich as saints and crowns of gold.
The old man snorted.
Long as I don't have to live like one. I'll talk to Pim,
Kaz said.
He can pick up the slack while I'm gone.
Inej frowned. Just where was Kaz going? He hadn't mentioned any big job to her, and why Pim? The thought shamed her a bit. She could almost hear her father's voice.
So ye got to be the queen of thieves, Inej.
It was one thing to do her job and do it well. It was quite another to want to succeed at it. She didn't want a permanent place with the dregs. She wanted to pay off her debts and be free of Ketterdam forever. So why should she care if Kaz chose Pim to run the gang in his absence?
Because I'm smarter than Pim.
Because Kaz trusts me more. But maybe he didn't trust the crew to follow a girl like her, only 2 years out of the brothels, not even 17 years old. She wore her sleeves long, and the sheath of her knife mostly hid the scar on the inside of her left forearm, where the menagerie tattoo had once been. But they all knew it was there. Kaz exited Haskell's room, and Inej left her perch to wait for him as he limped his way up the stairs.
Rojak,
he asked as he passed her and started up the second flight. Gone, she said, falling in behind him.
He put up much of a fight?
Nothing I couldn't handle.
Not what I asked.
He was angry. He may come back around looking for trouble.
Never a shortage of that to hand out,
Kaz said as they reached the top floor. The attic rooms had been converted into his office and bedroom. She knew all those flights of stairs were brutal on his bad leg, but he seemed to like having the whole floor to himself. He entered the office and, without looking back at her, said,
Shut the door.
The room was mostly taken up by a makeshift desk, an old warehouse door atop stacked fruit crates, piled high with papers. Some of the floor bosses had started using adding machines, clanking things crowded with stiff brass buttons and spools of paper. But Kaz did the Crow Club tallies in his head. He kept books, but only for the sake of the old man, and so that he had something to point to when he called someone out for cheating or when he was looking for new investors. That was one of the big changes Kaz had brought to the gang. He'd given ordinary shopkeepers and legitimate businessmen the chance to buy shares in the Crow Club. At first, they'd been skeptical. Sure, it was some kind of swindle, but he'd brought them in with tiny stakes and managed to gather enough capital to purchase the dilapidated old building, spruce it up, and get it running. It had paid back for those early investors, or so the story went. Inej could never be sure which stories about Kaz were true and which were rumors he'd planted to serve his own ends. For all she knew, he'd conned some poor, honest trader out of his life savings to make the Crow Club thrive.
I've got a job for you,
Kaz said as he flipped through the previous day's figures. Each sheet would go into his memory with barely a glance.
What would you say to 4 million Krug?
Money like that is more curse than gift.
My little Suli idealist, all you need is a full belly and an open road,
he said, the mockery clear in his voice.
And an easy heart, Kaz.
That was the difficult part. Now he laughed outright as he walked through the door to his tiny bedroom.
No hopes of that. I'd rather have the cash. Do you want the money or not?
You're not in the business of giving gifts. What's the job?
An impossible job. Near certain death, terrible odds, but should we scrape it?
He paused, fingers on the buttons of his waistcoat, his look distant, almost dreamy. It was rare that she heard such excitement in his raspy voice. Should we scrape it? She prompted. He grinned at her, his smile sudden and jarring as a thunderclap, his eyes the near black of bitter coffee.
There'll be kings and queens, Inej. Kings and queens.
She said noncommittally, pretending to examine one of her knives, determined to ignore that grin. Kaz was not a giddy boy smiling and making future plans with her. He was a dangerous player who was always working an angle. Always, she reminded herself firmly. Inej kept her eyes averted, shuffling a stack of papers into a pile on the desk as Kaz stripped out of his vest and shirt. She wasn't sure if she was flattered or insulted that he didn't seem to give a second thought to her presence. How long will we be gone? She asked, darting a glance at him through the open doorway. He was corded muscle, scars, but only two tattoos. The dregs Crow and Cup on his forearm, and above it a black R on his bicep. She'd never asked him what it meant. It was his hands that drew her attention as he shucked off his leather gloves and dipped a cloth in the wash basin. He only ever removed them in these chambers, and as far as she knew, only in front of her. Whatever affliction he might be hiding, she could see no sign of it. Only slender lockpick's fingers, and a shiny rope of scar tissue from some long-ago street fight.
A few weeks, maybe a month,
he said as he ran the wet cloth under his arms and the hard planes of his chest, water trickling down his torso. For saints' sake, Inej thought as her cheeks heated. She'd lost most of her modesty during her time with the menagerie, but really, there were limits. What would Kaz say if she suddenly stripped down and started washing herself in front of him? He'd probably tell me not to drip on the desk, she thought with a scowl. A month, she said. Are you sure you should be leaving with the black tip so riled up?
This is the right gamble. Speaking of which, round up Jesper and Muzzin. I want them here by dawn. And I'll need Wylan waiting at the Crow Club tomorrow night.
Wylan?
If this is for a big job, just do it.
Inej crossed her arms. One minute he made her blush, and the next he made her want to commit murder.
Are you going to explain any of this? When we all meet.
He shrugged on a fresh shirt, then hesitated as he fastened the collar.
This isn't an assignment, Inej. It's a job for you to take or leave as you see fit.
An alarm bell rang inside her. She endangered herself every day on the streets of the barrel. She'd murdered for the dregs, stolen, brought down bad men and good, and Kaz had never hinted that any of the assignments were less than a command to be obeyed. This was the price she'd agreed to when Per Haskell had purchased her contract and liberated her from the menagerie. So what was different about this job? Kaz finished with his buttons, pulled on a charcoal waistcoat, and tossed her something. It flashed in the air and she caught it with one hand. When she opened her fist, she saw a massive ruby tie pin circled by golden laurel leaves.
Fence it, Kaz said.
Whose is it?
Ours now.
Whose was it? Kaz stayed quiet. He picked up his coat, using a brush to clean the dried mud from it.
Someone who should have thought better before he had me jumped.
Jumped?
You heard me.
Someone got the drop on you. He looked at her and nodded once. Unease snaked through her and twisted into an anxious, rusting coil. No one got the better of Kaz. He was the toughest, scariest thing walking the alleys of the barrel. She relied on it. So did he.
It won't happen again, he promised.
Kaz pulled on a clean pair of gloves, snapped up his walking stick, and headed out the door.
I'll be back in a few hours. Move the decoupel we lifted from Van Eck's house to the vault. I think it's rolled up under my bed. Oh, and put in an order for a new hat. Please.
Kaz heaved a sigh as he braced himself for 3 painful flights of stairs. He looked over his shoulder and said,
Please. My darling Inesh, treasurer of my heart, won't you do me the honor of acquiring me a new hat?
Inesh cast a meaningful glance at his cane.
Have a long trip down, she said,
then leapt onto the banister, sliding from one flight to the next, slick as butter in a pan.
5. Kaz. Kaz followed East Stave toward the harbor, through the beginnings of the barrel's gambling district. The infamous tangle of narrow streets and minor waterways known as the barrel was bracketed by 2 major canals, East Stave and West Stave, each catering to a particular clientele. The buildings of the barrel were different from anywhere else in Ketterdam, bigger, wider, painted in every garish color, clamoring for attention from passers-by. The treasure chest, the Golden Bend, Weddell's riverboat. The best of the betting halls were located farther north, in the prime real estate of the Lid, the section of the canal closest to the harbors, favorably situated to attract tourists and sailors coming into port. But not the Crow Club. Kaz mused as he looked up at the black and crimson facade. It had taken a lot to lure tourists and risk hungry merchants this far south for entertainment. Now the hour was coming up on 4 bells, and the crowds were still thick outside the club. Kaz watched the tide of people flowing past the portico's black columns. Beneath the watchful eye of the oxidized silver crow that spread its wings above the entrance. Bless the pigeons, he thought. Bless all you kind and generous folk, ready to empty your wallets into the dregs' coffers and call it a good time. He could see barkers out front shouting to potential customers, offering free drinks, hot pots of coffee, and the fairest deals in all of Ketterdam. He acknowledged them with a nod and pressed farther north. Only one other gambling den on the Stave mattered to him. The Emerald Palace, Pekka Rollins' pride and joy. The building was an ugly green, decked out in artificial trees laden with fake gold and silver coins. The whole place had been done up as some kind of tribute to Rollins' Kalish heritage and his gang, the Dime Lions. Even the girls working the chip counters and tables wore glittering green sheaths of silk and had their hair tinted a dark, unnatural red to mimic the look of girls from the Wandering Isle. As Kaz passed the emerald, he looked up at the false gold coins, letting the anger come at him. He needed it tonight as a reminder of what he'd lost, of what he stood to gain. He needed it to prepare him for this reckless endeavor. Brick by brick, he muttered to himself. They were the only words that kept his rage in check, that prevented him from striding through the Emerald's garish gold and green doors, demanding a private audience with Rollins, and slitting his throat. Brick by brick. It was the promise that let him sleep at night, that drove him every day, that kept Geordi's ghost at bay. Because a quick death was too good for Pekka Rollins. Kaz watched the flow of customers in and out of the Emerald's doors and caught a glimpse of his own steerers, men and women he hired to seduce Pekka's customers south with the prospect of better deals, bigger wins, prettier girls. "Where are you coming from looking so flush?" one said to the other, talking far more loudly than necessary. "Just got back from the Crow Club. Took 100 Kruger off the house in just 2 hours. You don't say. I do. Just came up the stave to get a beer and meet a friend. Why don't you join us and we'll all go together? The Crow Club? Who would have thought it? Come on, I'll buy you a drink. I'll buy everyone a drink." And they walked off together laughing, leaving all the patrons around them to wonder if maybe they ought to head just a few bridges down the canal and see if the odds weren't kinder there. Kaz's servant, Greed, luring them south like a piper with flute in hand. He made sure to cycle steerers in and out, changing the faces so Pekka's barkers and bouncers never got wise. And customer by customer, he leached away the Emerald's business. It was one of the infinite, tiny ways he'd found to make himself strong at Pekka's expense. Intercepting his shipments of Geordi, charging him fees for access to Fifth Harbor, undercutting his rents to keep his properties free of tenants, and slowly, slowly tugging at the threads that made up his life. Despite the lies he'd spread and the claims he'd made to Giles tonight, Kaz wasn't a bastard. He wasn't even from Caterdam. He'd been 9, and Geordi 13 when they'd first arrived in the city. A check from the sale of their father's farm, sewn safely into the inner pocket of Geordi's old coat. Kaz could see himself as he was then, walking the stave with dazzled eyes, hand tucked into Geordi's, so he wouldn't be swept away by the crowd. He hated the boys they'd been, two stupid pigeons waiting to be plucked. But those boys were long gone, and only Pekka Rollins was left to punish. One day, Rollins would come to Kaz on his knees, begging for help. If Kaz managed this job for Vanek, that day would come much sooner than he could have ever hoped. "Brick by brick, I will destroy you." But if Kaz had any hope of getting into the ice court, he needed the right crew, and the next hour's business would bring him a step closer to securing two very vital pieces of the puzzle. He turned onto a walkway bordering one of the smaller canals. The tourists and merchants liked to keep to well-lit thoroughfares, so the foot traffic here was sparser, and he made better time. Soon the lights and music of West Stave came into view. The canal choked with men and women of every class and country seeking diversion. Music floated out of parlors where the doors had been flung open, and men and women lounged on couches in little more than scraps of silk and gaudy baubles. Acrobats dangled from cords over the canal, lithe bodies garbed in nothing but glitter, while street performers played their fiddles, hoping to garner a coin or two from passers-by. Hawkers shouted at the sleek private gondolas of rich merchants in the canal and the larger brow boats that brought tourists and sailors inland from the Lid. A lot of tourists never entered the brothels of West Stave. They just came to watch the crowd, which was a sight in itself. Many people chose to visit this part of the barrel in disguise, in veils or masks or capes with nothing but the glint of their eyes visible. They bought their costumes in one of the specialty shops off the main canals, and sometimes disappeared from their companions for a day, or a week, or however long their funds held out. They dressed as Mr. Crimson, or the Lost Bride, or wore the grotesque, goggle-eyed mask of the Madman, all characters from the comedy Brute. And then there were the Jackals, a group of rowdy men and boys who cavorted through the barrel in the red-lacquered masks of Sully fortune-tellers. Kaz remembered when Inej had first seen the Jackal masks in a shop window. She hadn't been able to contain her contempt. Real Sully fortune-tellers are rare. They're holy men and women. These masks that are handed around like party favors are sacred symbols. I've seen Sully tellers ply their trade in caravans and pleasure ships, Inej. They didn't seem so very holy. They are pretenders, making themselves clowns for you and your ilk. My ilk? Kaz had laughed. She'd waved her hand in disgust. Shavrati, she'd said. Know-nothings. They're laughing at you behind those masks. Not at me, Inej. I never laid down good coin to be told my fortune by anyone, fraud or holy man. Fate has plans for us all, Kaz. Was it fate that took you from your family and stuck you in a pleasure house in Caterdam? Or was it just very bad luck? I'm not sure yet, she said coldly. In moments like that, he thought she might hate him. Kaz wove his way through the crowd, a shadow in a riot of color. Each of the major pleasure houses had a specialty, some more obvious than others. He passed the Blue Iris, the Bandy Cat, bearded men glowering from the windows of the Forge, the Obscura, the Willow Switch, the dewy-eyed blondes at the House of Snow, and of course, the Menagerie, also known as the House of Exotics, where Inej had been forced to don fake Sully silks. He spotted Tanta Helene in her peacock feathers and famous diamond choker holding court in the gilded parlor. She ran the menagerie, procured the girls, made sure they behaved. When she saw Kaz, her lips thinned to a sour line, and she lifted her glass. The gesture more threat than toast. He ignored her and pressed on. The House of the White Rose was one of the most luxurious establishments on West Stave. It had its own dock, and its gleaming white stone facade looked less like a pleasure house than a mercher mansion. Its window boxes were always bursting with climbing white roses, and their scent clung dense and sweet over this portion of the canal. The parlor was even stickier with perfume. Huge alabaster vases overflowed with more white roses, and men and women, some masked or veiled, some with faces bare, waited on ivory couches, sipping near colorless wine and nibbling little vanilla cakes soaked in almond liqueur. The boy at the desk was dressed in a creamy velvet suit, a white rose in his buttonhole. He had white hair and colorless eyes. Barring the eyes, he looked like an albino, but Kaz happened to know that he'd been tailored to match the decor of the house by a certain Grisha on the payroll.
Mr. Brecker, the boy said. Nina is with a client.
Kaz nodded and slipped down a hallway behind a potted rose tree, resisting the urge to bury his nose in his collar. Uncle Felix, the bawd who ran the White Rose, liked to say that his house girls were as sweet as his blossoms. But the joke was on the clients. That particular breed of White Rose, the only one hardy enough to survive the wet weather of Caterdam, had no natural scent. All the flowers were perfumed by hand. Kaz trailed his fingers along the panels behind the potted tree and pressed his thumb into a notch in the wall. It slid open, and he climbed a corkscrew staircase that was only used by staff. Nina's room was on the third floor. The door to the bedroom beside it was open and the room unoccupied. So Kaz slipped in, moved aside a still life, and pressed his face to the wall. The peepholes were a feature of all the brothels. They were a way to keep employees safe and honest, and they offered a thrill to anyone who enjoyed watching others take their pleasure. Kaz had seen enough slum dwellers seeking satisfaction in dark corners and alleys that the allure was lost on him. Besides, he knew that anyone looking through this particular peephole and hoping for excitement would be sorely disappointed. A little bald man was seated fully clothed at a round table draped in ivory baize. His hands, neatly folded, beside an untouched silver coffee tray. Nina Zenick stood behind him, swathed in the red silk kefta that advertised her status as a Grisha Heartrender, one palm pressed to his forehead, the other to the back of his neck. She was tall and built like the figurehead of a ship carved by a generous hand. They were silent, as if they'd been frozen there at the table. There wasn't even a bed in the room, just a narrow settee where Nina curled up every night. When Kaz had asked Nina why, she'd simply said, "I don't want anyone getting ideas." "A man doesn't need a bed to get ideas, Nina." Nina fluttered her lashes. "What would you know about it, Kaz? Take those gloves off, and we'll see what ideas come to mind." Kaz had kept his cool eyes on her until she dropped her gaze. He wasn't interested in flirting with Nina Zanuck, and he happened to know she wasn't remotely interested in him. Nina just liked to flirt with everything. He'd once seen her make eyes at a pair of shoes she fancied in a shop window. Nina and the bald man sat, unspeaking, as the minutes ticked by, and when the hour on the clock chimed, he rose and kissed her hand. "Go," she said in solemn tones. "Be at peace." The bald man kissed her hand again, tears in his eyes.
"Thank you."
As soon as the client was down the hall, Kaz stepped out of the bedroom and knocked on Nina's door. She opened it cautiously, keeping the chain latched.
"Oh," she said, when she saw Kaz,
"you." She didn't look particularly happy to see him. No surprise. Kaz Brecker at your door was rarely a good thing. She unhooked the chain and let him show himself in as she shucked off the red kafta, revealing a slip of satin so thin it barely counted as cloth.
"Saints, I hate this thing," she said, kicking the kafta away and pulling a threadbare dressing gown from a drawer.
"What's wrong with it?" Kaz asked.
"It isn't made right, and it itches."
The kafta was of Kirch manufacture, not Ravkin. A costume, not a uniform. Kaz knew Nina never wore it on the streets. It was simply too risky for Grisha. Her membership in the dregs meant anyone acting against her would risk retribution from the gang. But payback wouldn't matter much to Nina if she was on a slaver ship bound for who knew where. Nina threw herself into a chair at the table and wriggled her feet out of her jeweled slippers, digging her toes into the plush white carpet.
"Ah," she said contentedly, "so much better."
She shoved one of the cakes from the coffee service into her mouth and mumbled,
"What do you want, Kaz? Do you have crumbs on your cleavage?"
"Don't care," she said, taking another bite of cake.
"So hungry."
Kaz shook his head, amused and impressed at how quickly Nina dropped the wise Grisha priestess act. She'd missed her true calling on the stage.
"Was that Van Oxter, the merch?" Kaz asked.
"Yes,"
His wife died a month ago, and his business had been a wreck since. Now that he's visiting you, can we expect a turnaround? Nina didn't need a bed because she specialized in emotions. She dealt in joy, calm, confidence. Most Grisha Korporalki focused on the body, to kill or to cure. But Nina had needed a job that would keep her in Ketterdam and out of trouble. So instead of risking her life and making major money as a mercenary, she slowed heartbeats, eased breathing, relaxed muscles. She had a lucrative side business as a tailor, seeing to the wrinkles and jowls of the wealthy Kirch, but her chief source of income came from altering moods. People came to her, lonely, grieving, sad, for no reason, and left buoyed, their anxieties eased. The effects didn't last long, but sometimes just the illusion of happiness was enough to make her clients feel like they could face another day. Nina claimed it had something to do with glands, but Kaz didn't care about the specifics as long as she showed up when he needed her and she paid Per Haskell his percentage on time. I expect you'll see a change, Nina said. She finished off the last cake, licking her fingers with a relish, then set the tray outside the door and rang for a maid. Van Oxter started coming at the end of last week and has been here every day since. Excellent. Kaz made a mental note to buy up some of the low stock in Van Oxter's company. Even if the man's mood shift was the result of Nina's handiwork, business would pick up. He hesitated, then said, You make him feel better, ease his woe and all that, but could you compel him to do something? Maybe make him forget his wife? Alter the pathways in his mind? Don't be absurd. The brain is just another organ, Kaz said, quoting Van Eck. Yes, but it's an incredibly complex one. Controlling or altering another person's thoughts? Well, it's not like lowering a pulse rate or releasing a chemical to improve someone's mood. There are too many variables. No Grisha is capable of it. Yet, Kaz amended. So, you treat the symptom, not the cause. She shrugged. He's avoiding the grief, not treating it. If I'm his solution, he'll never really get over her death. Will you send him on his way, then? Advise him to find a new wife and stop darkening your door? She ran a brush through her light brown hair and glanced at him in the mirror. Does Per Haskell have plans to forgive my debt? None at all. Well, then, Van Oxter must be allowed to grieve in his own way. I have another client scheduled in a half hour, Kaz. What business? Your client will wait. What do you know about Jorda Parem? Nina shrugged. There are rumors, but they sound like nonsense to me. With the exception of the Council of Tides, the few Grisha working in Ketterdam all knew each other and exchanged information readily. Most were on the run from something, eager to avoid drawing the attention of slavers or interest from the Ravkin government. They aren't just rumors. Squallers flying, tide makers turning to mist. Fabricators making gold from lead. He reached into his pocket and tossed the lump of yellow to her. It's real. Fabricators make textiles. They fuss around with metals and fabrics. They can't turn one thing into another. She held the lump up to the light. You could have gotten this anywhere, she said, just as he had argued to Van Eck a few hours earlier. Without being invited, Kaz sat down on the plush settee and stretched out his bad leg. Jorda Parem is real, Nina. And if you're still the good little Grisha soldier I think you are, you'll want to hear what it does to people like you. She turned the lump of gold over in her hands, then wrapped her dressing gown more tightly around her and curled up at the end of the settee. Again, Kaz marveled at the transformation. In these rooms, she played the part her clients wanted to see, the powerful Grisha, serene in her knowledge,
but sitting there with her brow furrowed and her feet tucked under her, she looked like what she truly was. A girl of 17, raised in the sheltered luxury of the little palace, far from home and barely getting by every day.
Tell me, she said.
Kaz talked. He held back on the specifics of Van Eck's proposal, but he told her about Bo Yul Bayur, Jurda Parem, and the addictive properties of the drug, placing particular emphasis on the recent theft of Ravkin military documents. If this is all true, then Bo Yul Bayur needs to be eliminated. That is not the job, Nina.
This isn't about money, Kaz.
It was always about money, but Kaz knew a different kind of pressure was required. Nina loved her country and loved her people. She still believed in the future of Ravka and in the Second Army, the Grisha military elite that had nearly disintegrated during the Civil War. Nina's friends back in Ravka believed she was dead, a victim of Fjordan witch hunters, and for now, she wanted it to stay that way. But Kaz knew she hoped to return one day. Nina, we're going to retrieve Bo Yul Bayur, and I need a Korporalnik to do it. I want you on my crew.
Wherever he's hiding out, once you find him, letting him live would be the most outrageous kind of irresponsibility. My answer is no.
He isn't hiding out. The Fjordans have him at the ice court. Nina paused.
Then he's as good as dead.
The Merchant Council doesn't think so. They wouldn't be going to this trouble or offering up this kind of reward if they thought he'd been neutralized. Van Eck was worried. I could see it.
The Mercher you spoke to?
Yes. He claims their intelligence is good. If it's not, well, I'll take the hit. But if Bo Yul Bayur is alive, someone is going to try to break him out of the ice court. Why shouldn't it be us?
The ice court? Nina repeated, and Kaz knew she'd begun to put the pieces together. You don't just need a Korporalnik, do you?
No. I need someone who knows the court inside and out. She leapt to her feet and began pacing, hands on hips, dressing gown, flapping.
You're a little skiv, you know that? How many times have I come to you begging you to help Matthias? And now that you want something?
Per Haskell isn't running a charity.
Don't put this on the old man, she snapped. If you'd wanted to help me, you know you could have.
And why would I do that?
She whirled on him.
Because. When have I ever done something for nothing, Nina? She opened her mouth, closed it again. Do you know how many favors I would have had to call in? How many bribes I'd have to pay you to get Matthias Helvar out of prison? The price was too high.
And now?
She managed, her eyes still blazing anger. Now? Helvar's freedom is worth something.
It...
He held up a hand to cut her off. Worth something to me. Nina pressed her fingers to her temples.
Even if you could get to him, Matthias would never agree to help you.
It's just a question of leverage, Nina.
You don't know him.
Don't I? He's a person like any other, driven by greed and pride and pain. You should understand that better than anyone.
Helvar is driven by honor and only honor. You can't bribe or bully that.
That may have been true once, Nina. But it's been a very long year. Helvar is much changed.
You've seen him?
Her green eyes were wide, eager. There, thought Kaz. The barrel hasn't beaten the hope out of you yet. I have. Nina took a deep, shuddering breath.
He wants his revenge, Kaz.
That's what he wants. Not what he needs, said Kaz. Leverage is all about knowing the difference.
6. Nina. The sick feeling in Nina's stomach had nothing to do with the rocking of the rowboat. She tried to breathe deeply, to focus on the lights of the Ketterdam harbor disappearing behind them, and the steady splash of the oars in the water. Beside her, Kaz adjusted his mask and cloak, while Muzzin rode with relentless and aggressive speed, driving them closer to Terrangel, one of Kirch's tiny outlying islands, closer to Hellgate and Matthias. Fog lay low over the water, damp and curling. It carried the smell of tar and machinery from the shipyards on Imperium, and something else. The sweet stink of burning bodies from the Reaper's barge, where Ketterdam disposed of the dead who couldn't afford to be buried in the cemeteries outside the city. Disgusting, Nina thought, drawing her cloak tighter around her. Why anyone would want to live in a city like this was beyond her. Muzzin hummed happily as he rode. Nina knew him only in passing, a bouncer and an enforcer, like the ill-fated Big Bolliger. She avoided the Slat and the Crow Club as much as possible. Kaz had branded her a snob for it, but she didn't much care what Kaz Brekker had to say about her tastes. She glanced back at Muzzin's huge shoulders. She wondered if Kaz had just brought him along to row, or because he expected trouble tonight. Of course there will be trouble. They were breaking into a prison. It wasn't going to be a party. So why are we dressed for one? She'd met Kaz and Muzzin at Fifth Harbor at midnight, and when she'd boarded the little rowboat, Kaz had handed her a blue silk cape and a matching veil, the trappings of the lost bride, one of the costumes pleasure seekers liked to don when they sampled the excesses of the barrel. He'd had on a big orange cape with a madman's mask perched atop his head. Muzzin had worn the same. All they needed was a stage, and they could perform one of those dark, savage little scenes from the Comedy Brute that the Kirch seemed to find so hilarious. Now Kaz gave her a nudge.
Lower your veil.
He pulled down his own mask. The long nose and bulging eyes looked doubly monstrous in the fog. She was about to give in and ask why the costumes were necessary when she realized that they weren't alone. Through the shifting mists, she caught sight of other boats moving through the water, carrying the shapes of other madmen, other brides, a Mr. Crimson, a scarab queen. What business did these people have at Hellgate? Kaz had refused to tell her the specifics of his plan, and when she'd insisted, he'd simply said,
"Get in the boat."
That was Kaz all over. He knew he didn't have to tell her anything because the lure of Matthias's freedom had already overridden every bit of her good sense. She'd been trying to talk Kaz into breaking Matthias out of jail for the better part of a year. Now he could offer Matthias more than freedom. But the price would be far higher than she had expected. Only a few lights were visible as they approached the rocky shoal of Terrangel. The rest was darkness and crashing waves. "Couldn't you just bribe the warden?" she muttered to Kaz.
"I don't need him knowing he has something I want."
When the boat's hull scraped sand, two men rushed forward to haul them farther onto land. The other boats she'd seen were making ground in the same cove, being pulled ashore by more grunting and cursing men. Their features were vague through the gauze of her veil, but Nina glimpsed the tattoos on their forearms. A feral cat curled into a crown. The symbol of the Dime Lions.
"Money,"
one of them said, as they clambered out of the boat. Kaz handed over a stack of kruga, and once it was counted, the Dime Lion waved them on. They followed a row of torches up an uneven path to the leeward side of the prison. Nina tilted her head back to gaze at the high black towers of the fortress known as Hellgate, a dark fist of stone thrusting up from the sea. She'd seen it from afar before, when she'd paid a fisherman to take her out to the island. But when she'd asked him to bring her closer, he'd refused.
"Sharks get mean there,"
he'd claimed.
"Bellies full of convict blood."
Nina shuddered at the memory. A door had been propped open, and another member of the Dime Lions led Nina and the others inside. They entered a dark, surprisingly clean kitchen, its walls lined with huge vats that looked better suited to laundry than cooking. The room smelled strange, like vinegar and sage. "Like a mercher's kitchen," Nina thought. The Kirch believed that work was akin to prayer. Maybe the merchant wives came here to scrub the floors and walls and windows, to honor Gezin, the god of industry and commerce, with soap and water and the chafing of their hands. Nina resisted the urge to gag. They could scrub all they liked. Beneath that wholesome scent was the indelible stench of mildew, urine, and unwashed bodies. It might take an actual miracle to dislodge it. They passed through a dank entry hall, and she thought they would head up into the cells, but instead, they passed through another door and onto a high stone walkway that connected the main prison to what looked like another tower.
Where are we going?
Nina whispered. Kaz didn't answer. The wind picked up, lifting her veil and lashing her cheeks with salt spray. As they entered the second tower, a figure emerged from the shadows, and Nina barely stifled a scream.
Inej,
she said on a wavering breath. The Suli girl wore the horns and high-necked tunic of the Gray Imp, but Nina recognized her anyway. No one else moved like that, as if the world were smoke and she was just passing through it.
How did you even get here?
Nina whispered to her. I came earlier on a supply barge. Nina ground her teeth.
Do people just come and go from Hellgate for fun?
Once a week they do, said Inej, her little imp horns bobbing along with her head.
What do you mean once a-
Keep quiet,
Kaz growled.
Don't shush me, Brecker, Nina whispered furiously. If it's this easy to get into Hellgate-
The problem isn't getting in, it's getting out. Now shut up and stay alert.
Nina swallowed her anger. She had to trust Kaz to run the game. He'd made sure she didn't have any other choice. They entered a tight passageway. This tower felt different from the first. Older, its rough-hewn stone walls blackened by smoking torches. Their Dime Lion guide pushed open a heavy iron door and gestured for them to follow him down a steep staircase. Here, the smell of bodies and refuse was worse, trapped by the sweating moisture of salt water. They spiraled lower, into the bowels of the rock. Nina clung to the wall. There was no banister, and though she could not see the bottom, she doubted the fall would be kind. They didn't go far, but by the time they reached their destination, she was trembling, her muscles wound taut, less from exertion than the knowledge that Matthias was somewhere in this terrible place.
He is here. He is under this roof. Where are we?
She whispered, as they ducked through cramped stone tunnels, passing dark caves fitted with iron bars.
This is the old prison, Kaz said. When they built the new tower, they left this one standing.
She heard moaning from inside one of the cells.
They still keep prisoners here?
Only the worst of them.
She peered between the bars of an empty cell. There were shackles on the wall, dark with rust and what might have been blood. Through the walls, a sound reached Nina's ears, a steady pounding. She thought it was the ocean at first, but then she realized it was chanting. They emerged into a curving tunnel. To her right were more old cells, but light poured into the tunnel from staggered archways on the left, and through them she glimpsed a roaring, rowdy crowd. The Dime Lion led them around the tunnel to the third archway, where a prison guard dressed in a blue and gray uniform was posted, rifle slung across his back.
Four more for you,
the Dime Lion shouted over the crowd. Then he turned to Kaz.
If you need to leave, the guard will call for an escort. No one goes wandering off without a guide. Understood.
Of course, wouldn't dream of it, Kaz said from behind his ridiculous mask.
Enjoy,
the Dime Lion said with an ugly grin. The prison guard waved them through. Nina stepped under the arch and felt as if she'd fallen into some strange nightmare. They were on a jutting stone ledge, looking down into a shallow, crudely made amphitheater. The tower had been gutted to create an arena. Only the black walls of the old prison remained, the roof long since fallen in or destroyed, so that the night sky was visible high above,
dense with clouds and free of stars. It was like standing in the hollowed-out trunk of a massive tree, something long dead and howling with echoes. Around her, masked and veiled men and women crowded onto the terraced ledges, stamping their feet as the action proceeded below. The walls surrounding the fighting pit blazed with torchlight, and the sand of the arena floor was red and damp where it had soaked up blood. In front of the dark mouth of a cave, a scrawny, bearded man in shackles stood next to a big wooden wheel, marked with what looked like drawings of little animals. He'd clearly once been strong, but now his skin hung in loose folds and his muscles sagged. A younger man stood beside him in a mangy cape made from a lion's skin, his face framed by the big cat's mouth. A garish gold crown had been secured between the lion's ears, and its eyes had been replaced with bright silver dimes. "Spin the wheel," the young man commanded. The prisoner lifted his shackled hands and gave the wheel a hard spin. A red needle ticked along the edges as it spun, making a cheerful clattering noise. Then slowly, the wheel came to a stop. Nina couldn't quite make out the symbol, but the crowd bellowed, and the man's shoulders drooped as a guard came forward to unlock his chains. The prisoner cast them aside into the sand, and a second later Nina heard it, a roar that carried even over the excited baying of the crowd. The man in the lion cape and the prison guard stepped hurriedly into a rope ladder and were lifted out of the pit to the safety of a ledge, as the prisoner seized a flimsy-looking knife from a bloody bunch of weapons lying in the sand. He backed as far away from the mouth of the tunnel as he could get. Nina had never seen a creature like the one that crawled into view from the tunnel. It was some kind of reptile, its thick body covered in gray-green scales, its head wide and flat, its yellow eyes slitted. It moved slowly, sinuously, its low-slung body sliding lazily over the ground. There was a white crust around the broad crescent of its mouth, and when it opened its jaws to roar again, something wet, white and foaming dripped from its pointed teeth. "What is that thing?" Nina asked. "Rinka Moten," said Inej, "a desert lizard. The poison from its mouth is lethal." "It seems pretty slow on its feet." "Yes, it seems that way." The prisoner lunged forward with his knife. The big lizard moved so quickly Nina could barely track it. One moment, the prisoner was bearing down on it. The next, the lizard was on the other side of the arena. Bare seconds later, it had slammed into the prisoner, pinning him to the ground as he screamed, its poison dripping over his face, leaving smoky trails wherever it touched his skin. The creature dropped its weight on the prisoner with a sickening crunch and set about slowly mauling his shoulder as he lay there shrieking. The crowd was booing. Nina averted her eyes, unable to watch. "What is this?"
"Welcome to the Hell Show," said Kaz. "Pekka Rollins got the idea a few years back and pitched it to the right council member."
"The Merchant Council knows?"
"Of course they know, Nina. There's money to be made here."
Nina dug her fingernails into her palms. That condescending tone made Kaz so slappable. She knew Pekka Rollins' name well. He was the reigning king of the barrel, the owner of not one but two gambling palaces, one luxurious, the other catering to sailors with less to line their pockets, and several of the higher-end brothels. When Nina had arrived in Ketterdam a year ago, she'd been friendless, penniless, and far from home. She'd spent the first week in the Kirch law courts, dealing with the charges against Matthias. But once her testimony was complete, she'd been unceremoniously dumped at First Harbor with just enough money to book passage back to Ravka. Desperate as she'd been to return to her country, she'd known she couldn't leave Matthias to languish in Hellgate. She had no idea what to do, but it seemed rumors of a new Grisha Korporalnik in Ketterdam had already circulated through the city. Pekka Rollins' men had been waiting for her at the harbor, with the promise of safety and a place to stay. They'd taken her to the Emerald Palace, where Pekka himself had leaned heavily on Nina to join the Dime Lions,
and had offered to set her up in business at the sweet shop. She'd been close to saying yes, desperate for cash and terrified of the slavers who patrolled the streets. But that night, Inej had crawled through her window on the top floor of the Emerald Palace with a proposal from Kaz Brekker in hand. Nina never could figure out how Inej had managed to scale 6 rain-slick stories of stone in the middle of the night. But the dreg's terms were far more favorable than those offered by Pekka and the Dime Lions. It was a contract that she might actually pay off in a year or two, if she was smart with her money. And Kaz had sent the right person to argue his case. A Suli girl just a few months younger than Nina, who had grown up in Ravka, and who had spent a very ugly year indentured at the menagerie. "What can you tell me about Per Haskell?" Nina had asked that night. "Not much," Inej had admitted. "He's no better or worse than most of the bosses in the barrel." "And Kaz Brekker?" "A liar, a thief, and utterly without conscience. But he'll keep to any deal you strike with him." Nina had heard the conviction in her voice. "He freed you from the menagerie?" "There is no freedom in the barrel, only good terms. Tanta Helene's girls never earn out of their contracts. She makes sure they don't. She—" Inej had broken off then, and Nina had sensed the vibrant anger coursing through her. "Kaz convinced Per Haskell to pay off my indenture. I would have died at the menagerie."
"You may still die in the dregs."
Inej's dark eyes had glinted.
"I may, but I'll die on my feet with a knife in my hand."
The next morning, Inej had helped Nina sneak out of the Emerald Palace. They'd met with Kaz Brekker, and despite his cold ways and those strange leather gloves, she'd agreed to join the dregs and work out of the White Rose. Less than 2 days later, a girl died at the sweet shop, strangled in her bed by a customer dressed as Mr. Crimson, who was never found. Nina had trusted Inej, and she hadn't been sorry for it, though right now she felt furious with everyone. She watched a group of Dime Lions prod the desert lizard with long spears. Apparently, the monster was sated after its meal. It allowed itself to be herded back to the tunnel, its thick body moving side to side in a lazy, sinuous roll. The crowd continued to boo as guards entered the arena to remove the prisoner's remains, tendrils of smoke still curling from his ruined flesh.
"Why are they complaining?" Nina asked angrily. "Isn't this what they came here for?"
"They wanted a fight," said Kaz. "They were expecting him to last longer."
"This is disgusting."
Kaz shrugged. "Only disgusting thing about it is that I didn't think of it first."
"These men aren't slaves, Kaz. They're prisoners."
"They're murderers and rapists."
"And thieves and con artists. Your people."
"Nina, sweet, they aren't forced to fight. They line up for the chance. They earn better food, private cells, liquor, jurda, conjugals with girls from West Stave."
Muzzin cracked his knuckles.
"Sounds better than we got it at the slat."
Nina looked at the people screaming and shouting, the barkers walking the aisles taking bets. The prisoners of Hellgate might line up to fight, but Pekka Rollins made the real money.
Helvar doesn't fight in the arena, does he?"
"We aren't here for the ambiance," Kaz said.
"Beyond slappable.
Are you aware that I could waggle my fingers and make you wet your trousers?"
"Easy, Heartrender. I like these trousers. And if you start messing with my vital organs, Matthias Helvar will never see sunshine again."
Nina blew out a breath and settled for glowering at no one.
"Nina," Inej murmured, "don't you start in on me." "It will all work out. Let Kaz do what he does best."
"He's horrible."
"But effective. Being angry at Kaz for being ruthless is like being angry at a stove for being hot. You know what he is."
Nina crossed her arms. "I'm mad at you, too."
"Me? Why?"
"I don't know yet. I just am."
Inej gave Nina's hand a brief squeeze, and after a moment, Nina squeezed back.
She sat through the next fight in a daze, and the next. She told herself she was ready for this, to see him again, to see him here in this brutal place. After all, she was a Grisha, and a soldier of the Second Army. She'd seen worse. But when Matthias emerged from the mouth of the cave below, she knew she'd been wrong. Nina recognized him instantly. Every night of the past year, she had fallen asleep thinking of Matthias' face. There was no mistaking the gilded brows, the sharp cut of his cheekbones. But Kaz hadn't lied. Matthias was much changed. The boy who looked back at the crowd with fury in his eyes was a stranger. Nina remembered the first time she'd seen Matthias in a moonlit Kalish wood. His beauty had seemed unfair to her. In another life, she might have believed he was coming to rescue her. A shining savior with golden hair and eyes the pale blue of northern glaciers. But she'd known the truth of him by the language he spoke, and by the disgust on his face every time his eyes lighted on her. Matthias Helvar was a Druskela, one of the Fjerdan witch hunters tasked with hunting down Grisha to face trial and execution. Though to her, he'd always resembled a warrior saint, illuminated in gold. Now he looked like what he truly was, a killer. His bare torso seemed hewn from steel, and though she knew it wasn't possible, he seemed bigger, as if the very structure of his body had changed. His skin had been gilded honey. Now it was fish belly white beneath the grime. And his hair. He'd had such beautiful hair, thick and golden, worn long in the way of Fjerdan soldiers. Now, like the other prisoners, his head had been shaved, probably to prevent lice. Whichever guard had done it had made a mess of the job. Even from this distance, she could see the cuts and nicks on his scalp, and little strips of blonde stubble in the places the razor had missed. And yet, he was beautiful still. He glared at the crowd, and gave the wheel a hard spin that nearly knocked it off its base. Tick, 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 tick. Snakes, tiger, bear, boar. The wheel ticked merrily along, then slowed and finally stopped. No, Nina said, when she saw where the needle was pointing.
It could be worse, said Muzzin. Could have landed on the desert lizard again.
She grabbed Kaz's arm through his cloak and felt his muscles tense. You have to stop this.
Let go of me, Nina.
His gravel rough voice was low, but she sensed real menace in it. She dropped her hand. Please, you don't understand.
If he survives, I'll take Matthias Helvar out of this place tonight. But this part is up to him.
Nina gave a frustrated shake of her head. You don't get it. The guard unbolted Matthias' shackles, and as soon as the chains dropped into the sand, he leapt onto the ladder with the announcer to be lifted to safety. The crowd screamed and stamped. But Matthias stood silent, unmoving. Even when the gate opened, even when the wolves charged out of the tunnel, three of them snarling and snapping, tumbling over one another to get to him. At the last second, Matthias dropped into a crouch, knocking the first wolf into the dirt, then rolling right to pick up the bloodied knife the previous combatant had left in the sand. He sprang to his feet, blade held out before him, but Nina could sense his reluctance. His head was cocked to one side, and the look in his blue eyes was pleading, as if he was trying to engage the two wolves circling him in some silent negotiation. Whatever the plea might have been, it went unheard. The wolf on the right lunged. Matthias crouched low and spun, lodging his knife in the wolf's belly. It gave a miserable yelp, and Matthias seemed to shudder at the sound. It cost him precious seconds. The third wolf was on him, knocking him to the sand. Its teeth sank into his shoulder. He rolled, taking the wolf with him. The wolf's jaws snapped, and Matthias caught them. He wrenched them apart, the muscles of his arms flexing, his face grim. Nina squeezed her eyes shut. There was a sickening crack. The crowd roared. Matthias knelt over the wolf. Its jaw was broken, and it lay on the ground, twitching in pain.
He reached for a rock and slammed it hard into the poor animal's skull. It went still, and Matthias's shoulders slumped. The people howled, stomping their feet. Only Nina knew what this was costing him, that he'd been a Druskella. Wolves were sacred to his kind, bred for battle like their enormous horses. They were friends and companions, fighting side by side with their Druskella masters. The first wolf had recovered and was circling.
Move, Matthias, she thought desperately.
He got to his feet, but his movements were slow, weary. His heart wasn't in this fight. His opponents were gray wolves, rangy and wild, but cousins to the white wolves of the Fjärden North. Matthias had no knife, only the bloody rock in his hand, and the remaining wolf prowled the arena between him and the pile of weapons. The wolf lowered its head and bared its teeth. Matthias dove left. The wolf lunged, sinking its teeth into his side. He grunted and hit the ground hard. For a moment, Nina thought he might simply give in and let the wolf take his life. Then he reached out, hand scrabbling through the sand, searching for something. His fingers closed over the shackles that had bound his wrists. He seized them, looped the chain across the wolf's throat, and pulled, the veins in his neck cording from the strain. His bloody face was pressed against the wolf's ruff, his eyes tightly shut, his lips moving. What was he saying? A Druskella prayer? A farewell? The wolf's hind legs scrabbled at the sand. Its eyes rolled, frightened whites showing bright against its matted fur. A high whine rose from its chest. And then it was over. The creature's body stilled. Both fighters lay unmoving in the sand. Matthias kept his eyes closed, his face still buried in the creature's fur. The crowd thundered its approval. The ladder was lowered, and the announcer sprang down, hauling Matthias to his feet and grabbing his wrist to raise his hand in victory. The announcer gave him a little nudge, and Matthias lifted his head. Nina caught her breath. Tears streaked the dirt on Matthias' face. The rage was gone, and it was like some flame had gone out with it. His North Sea eyes were colder than she'd ever seen them, empty of feeling, stripped of anything human at all. This was what Hellgate had done to him, and it was her fault. The guards took hold of Matthias again, pulling the shackles from the wolf's throat and clapping them back on his wrists. As he was led away, the crowd chanted its disapproval, clamoring more, more.
Where are they taking him?
Nina asked, voice trembling.
To a cell to sleep off the fight, Kaz said.
Who will see to his injuries?
They have medics. We'll wait to make sure he's alone.
I could heal him, she thought.
But a darker voice rose in her, rich with mocking. Not even you can be that foolish, Nina. No healer can cure that boy. You made sure of it.
She thought she would leap from her skin as the minutes burned away. The others watched the next fight, Muzzin avidly, flexing his fingers and speculating on the outcome. Inej silent and still as a statue. Kaz, inscrutable as always, scheming away behind that hideous mask.
Nina slowed her own breathing, forced her pulse lower, trying to calm herself. But she could do nothing to mute the riot in her head. Finally, Kaz gave her a nudge.
Ready, Nina? The guard first.
She cast a glance at the prison guard standing by the archway.
How down?
It was a barrel turn of phrase. How badly do you want him hurt?
Should I?
Knock him out, but don't actually hurt him. They followed Kaz to the arch through which they'd entered. The rest of the crowd took little notice, eyes focused on the fighting below.
Need your escort?
The guard asked as they approached.
I had a question, said Kaz.
Beneath her cape, Nina lifted her hands, sensing the flow of blood in the guard's veins, the tissue of his lungs.
About your mother, and whether the rumors are true.
Nina felt the guard's pulse leap and sighed.
Never can make it easy, can you, Kaz?
The guard stepped forward, lifting his gun.
What did you say? I...
His eyelids drooped. You don't... Nina dropped his pulse, and he toppled forward.
Muzzin grabbed him before he could fall, as Inej swept him into the cloak Kaz had been wearing just moments before. Nina was only mildly surprised to see that Kaz was wearing a prison guard's uniform beneath it.
Couldn't you have just asked him the time or something? Nina said. And where did you get that uniform?
Inej slid the madman's mask down over the guard's face, and Muzzin threw his arm around him, holding him up as if the guard had been drinking too much. They deposited him on one of the benches pressed against the back wall. Kaz tugged on the sleeves of his uniform.
Nina, people love to give up authority to men in nice clothes. I have uniforms for the Stadwatch, the harbor police, and the livery of every merch mansion on the Guildstraat.
Let's go. They slipped down the passageway. Instead of turning back the way they'd come, they moved counterclockwise around the old tower, the wall of the arena vibrating with voices and stomping feet to their left.
The guards posted at each archway paid them little more than a glance, though a few nodded at Kaz, who kept a brisk pace, his face buried in his collar. Nina was so deep in thought that she nearly missed it when Kaz held up a hand for them to slow. They'd rounded a bend between two archways and were in the cover of deep shadow. Ahead of them, a medic was emerging from a cell accompanied by guards, one carrying a lantern.
He'll sleep through the night, the medic said. Make sure he drinks something in the morning and check his pupils. I had to give him a powerful sleeping draft.
As the men moved off in the opposite direction, Kaz gestured his group forward. The door in the rock was solid iron, broken only by a narrow slot through which to pass the prisoners' meals. Kaz bent to the lock. Nina eyed the crude iron door.
This place is barbaric.
Most of the better fighters sleep in the old tower, Kaz replied. Keeps them away from the rest of the population.
Nina glanced left and right to where bright light spilled from the arena entryways. There were guards standing in those doorways, distracted maybe, but all one needed to do was turn his head.
If they were caught here,
would the guards bother giving them over to the Stadwatch for trial? Or would they simply force them into the ring to be eaten by a tiger?
Maybe something less dignified, she thought bleakly. A swarm of angry voles.
It took Kaz a few quick heartbeats to pick the lock. The door creaked open, and they slipped inside. The cell was pitch black. A brief moment passed, and the cold green glow of a bone light flickered to life beside her. Inej held the little glass sphere aloft. The substance inside was made from the dried and crushed bodies of luminous deep-sea fishes. They were common among crooks in the barrel who didn't want to get caught in a dark alley, but couldn't be bothered to lug around lanterns.
At least it's clean, Nina thought, as her eyes adjusted to the gloom. Barren and icy cold, but not filthy.
She saw a pallet of horse blankets and two buckets placed against the wall, one with a bloody cloth peeking over the rim. This was what the men of Hellgate competed for. A private cell, a blanket, clean water, and a bucket for waste. Matthias slept with his back to the wall. Even in the dim illumination of the bone light, she could see his face was starting to swell. Some kind of ointment had been smeared over his wounds. Calendula. She recognized the smell. Nina moved toward him, but Kaz stopped her with a hand on her arm.
Let Inej assess the damage.
I can, Nina began.
I need you to work on Muzzin.
Inej tossed Kaz the crow-headed cane she must have been hiding beneath her gray imp costume, and knelt over Matthias' body with the bone light. Muzzin stepped forward. He removed his cloak and shirt and the madman's mask. His head was shaved, and he wore prison-issue trousers. Nina looked at Matthias, then back to Muzzin, grasping what Kaz had in mind. The two boys were about the same height and the same build, but that was where the similarities ended.
You can't possibly mean for Muzzin to take Matthias's place.
He isn't here for his sparkling conversation, Kaz replied.
You'll need to reproduce Helvar's injuries. Inej, what's the inventory?
Bruised knuckles, chipped tooth, two broken ribs. Inej said, third and fourth on the left.
His left or your left?
Kaz asked. His left.
This isn't going to work, Nina said in frustration. I can match the damage to Helvar's body, but I'm not a good enough tailor to make Muzzin look like him.
Just trust me, Nina.
I wouldn't trust you to tie my shoes without stealing the laces, Kaz.
She peered at Muzzin's face.
Even if I swell him up, he'll never pass.
Tonight, Matthias Helvar, or rather our dear Muzzin, is going to appear to contract firepox, the lupin strain, carried by wolves and dogs alike. Tomorrow morning, when his guards discover him so covered in pustules that he is unrecognizable, he will be quarantined for a month to see if he survives the fever and to outweigh the contagion. Meanwhile, Matthias will be with us. Get it?
You want me to make Muzzin look like he has firepox?
Yes, and do it quickly, Nina, because in about 10 minutes things are going to get very hectic around here.
Nina stared at him. What was Kaz planning?
No matter what I do to him, it won't last a month. I can't give him a permanent fever.
My contact in the infirmary will make sure he stays sick enough. We just need him to get through the diagnosis. Now get to work.
Nina looked Muzzin up and down.
This is going to hurt just as much as if you'd been in the fight yourself, she warned.
He scrunched up his face, bracing for the pain.
I can take it.
She rolled her eyes, then lifted her hands, concentrating. With a sharp slice of her right hand over her left, she snapped Muzzin's ribs. He let out a grunt and doubled over.
That's a good boy, Kaz, taking it like a champion.
Knuckles next, then face. Nina spread bruises and cuts over Muzzin's knuckles and arms, matching the wounds to Inej's descriptions.
I've never seen firepox up close, Nina said.
She was only familiar with illustrations from books they'd used in their anatomy training at the Little Palace.
Count yourself lucky, Kaz said grimly.
Hurry it up.
She worked from memory, swelling and cracking the skin on Muzzin's face and chest, raising blisters until the swelling and pustules were so bad that he was truly unrecognizable. The big man moaned.
Why would you agree to do this? Nina murmured.
The swollen flesh of Muzzin's face quivered, and Nina thought he might be trying to smile.
Money was good,
he said thickly. She sighed. Why else did anyone do anything in the barrel?
Good enough to get locked up in Hellgate?
Kaz tapped his cane on the cell floor. Stop making trouble, Nina. If Helvar cooperates, he and Muzzin will both have their freedom just as soon as the job is done.
And if he doesn't?
Then Helvar gets locked back in his cell, and Muzzin still gets paid. And I'll take him to breakfast at the Cooperom.
Can I have waffles?
Muzzin mumbled. We'll all have waffles. And whiskey. If this job doesn't come off, no one's going to want to be around me sober. Finished, Nina?
Nina nodded, and Inej took her place to bandage Muzzin to look like Matthias.
All right, said Kaz. Get Helvar on his feet.
Nina crouched beside Matthias as Kaz stood over her with the bone light. Even in sleep, Matthias's features were troubled, his pale brows furrowed. She let her hands travel over the bruised line of his jaw, resisting the urge to linger there.
Not the face, Nina. I need him mobile, not pretty. Heal him fast, and only enough to get him walking for now. I don't want him spry enough to vex us.
Nina lowered the blanket and went to work. Just another body, she told herself.
She was always getting late-night calls from Kaz to heal wounded members of the dregs, who he didn't want to bring around to any legitimate medic. Girls with stabbing punctures, boys with broken legs or bullets lodged inside them. Victims of a scuffle with the Stadwatch or another gang.
Pretend it's Muzzin, she told herself. Or Big Bolliger, or some other fool. You don't know this boy.
And it was true. The boy she knew might have been the scaffold, but something new had been built upon it. She touched his shoulder gently.
Helvar, she said.
He didn't stir.
Matthias.
A lump rose in her throat, and she felt the ache of tears threatening. She pressed a kiss to his temple. She knew that Kaz and the others were watching, and that she was making an idiot of herself. But after so long, he was finally here, in front of her, and so very broken.
Matthias,
she repeated.
Nina.
His voice was raw, but as lovely as she remembered.
Oh, saints, Matthias, she whispered. Please wake up.
His eyes opened, groggily, palest blue.
Nina,
he said softly. His knuckles brushed her cheek. His rough hand cupped her face tentatively, disbelieving.
Nina?
Her eyes filled with tears.
Shh, Matthias. We're here to get you out.
Before she could blink, he had hold of her shoulders and had pinned her to the ground.
Nina,
he growled. Then his hands closed over her throat.
Part 2. Servant and Lever.
7. Matthias. Matthias was dreaming again, dreaming of her. In all his dreams, he hunted her, sometimes through the new green meadows of spring, but usually through the ice fields, dodging boulders and crevasses with unerring steps. Always he chased, and always he caught her. In the good dreams, he slammed her to the ground and throttled her, watching the life drain from her eyes, heart full of vengeance. Finally, finally. In the bad dreams, he kissed her. In these dreams, she didn't fight him. She laughed as if the chase was nothing but a game, as if she'd known he would catch her, as if she'd wanted him to, and there was no place she'd rather be than beneath him. She was welcoming and perfect in his arms. He kissed her, buried his face in the sweet hollow of her neck. Her curls brushed his cheeks, and he felt that if he could just hold her a little longer, every wound, every hurt, every bad thing would melt away.
Matthias,
she would whisper, his name so soft on her lips. These were the worst dreams, and when he woke, he hated himself almost as much as he hated her. To know that he could betray himself, betray his country again, even in sleep. To know that, after everything she'd done, some sick part of him still hungered after her. It was too much. Tonight was a bad dream. Very bad. She was wearing blue silk, clothes far more luxurious than anything he'd ever seen her in. Some kind of gauzy veil was caught up in her hair, the lamplight glinting off it like caught rain. Gel, she smelled good. The mossy damp was still there, but the perfume, too. Nina loved luxury, and this was expensive. Roses and something else, something his pauper's nose didn't recognize. She pressed her soft lips to his temple, and he could swear she was crying.
Matthias.
Nina, he managed.
Oh, saints, Matthias, she whispered. Please wake up.
And then he was awake, and he knew he'd gone mad because she was here, in his cell, kneeling beside him, her hand resting gently on his chest.
Matthias, please.
The sound of her voice pleading with him. He'd dreamed of this. Sometimes she pleaded for mercy. Sometimes there were other things she begged for. He reached up and touched her face. She had the softest skin. He'd laughed at her for it once. No real soldier had skin like that, he'd told her. Pampered, coddled. He'd mocked the lushness of her body, ashamed of his own response to her. He cupped the warm curve of her cheek, felt the soft brush of her hair. So lovely, so real. It wasn't fair. Then he registered the bloody wrappings on his hands. Pain rushed at him as he came fully awake, cracked ribs, aching knuckles. He chipped a tooth. He wasn't sure when, but he'd cut his tongue against it at some point. His mouth still held the coppery taste of blood. The wolves. They'd made him murder wolves. He was awake. Nina. There were tears in her beautiful green eyes. Rage coursed through him. She had no right to tears, no right to pity.
Shh, Matthias. We're here to get you out.
What game was this? What new cruelty? He'd just learned to survive in this monstrous place, and now she'd come to heap some fresh torture on him. He launched himself forward, flipping her to the ground, hands fastened tight around her throat, straddling her so that his knees pinned her arms to the ground. He knew damn well that Nina, with her hands free, was a deadly thing. Nina, he gritted out. She clawed at his hands. Witch, he hissed, leaning over her. He saw her eyes widen, her face getting redder. Beg me, he said. Beg me for your life. He heard a click, and a gravelly voice said, Hands off her, Helvar. Someone behind him had pressed a gun to his neck. Matthias didn't spare him a glance. Go ahead and shoot me, he said. He dug his fingertips deeper into Nina's neck. Nothing would deprive him of this. Nothing. Traitor, witch, abomination. All those words came to him, but others crowded in too. Beautiful, charmed one. Rod Fetla, he'd called her. Little red bird, for the color of her Grisha order. The color she loved. He squeezed harder, silencing that weak-willed strain inside him. If you've actually lost your mind, this is going to be a lot tougher than I thought, said that raspy voice. He heard a whoosh like something moving through the air, then a wrenching pain shot through his left shoulder. It felt like he'd been punched by a tiny fist, but his entire arm went numb. He grunted as he fell forward, one hand still clamped around Nina's throat. He would have fallen directly onto her, but he was yanked backward by the collar of his shirt. A boy wearing a guard's uniform stood before him, dark eyes glittering, a pistol in one hand, a walking stick in another. Its handle was carved to look like a crow's head, with a cruelly pointed beak. Get hold of yourself, Helvar. We're here to break you out. I can do to your leg what I did to your arm, and we can drag you out of here, or you can leave like a man, on 2 feet. No one gets out of Hellgate, Matthias said. Tonight they do. Matthias sat forward, trying to get his bearings, clutching his dead arm. You can't just walk me out of here. The guards will recognize me, he snarled. I'm not losing fighting privileges to be carted off Jell knows where with you. You'll be masked. If the guards check, they're going to be too busy to check, said the strange, pale boy. And then the screaming started. Matthias' head jerked up. He heard the thunder of footsteps from the arena, cresting like a wave as people burst into the passageway outside his cell. He heard the shouts of guards, and then the roaring of a great cat, the trumpet of an elephant. You opened the cages. Nina's voice was shaky with disbelief, though who knew what might be real or performance with her. He refused to look in her direction. If he did, he'd lose all sense of reality. He was barely hanging on as it was. Jesper was supposed to wait until 3 bells, said the pale boy.
It is 3 bells, Kaz, replied a small girl in the corner with dark hair and deep bronze Suli skin.
A figure covered in welts and bandages was leaning against her.
Since when is Jesper punctual? The boy complained with a glance at his watch. On your feet, Helvar.
He offered him a gloved hand. Matthias stared at it. This is a dream, the strangest dream I've ever had, but definitely a dream. Or maybe killing the wolves had finally driven him truly mad. He'd murdered family tonight. No whispered prayers for their wild souls would make it right. He looked up at the pale demon with his black-gloved hands. Kaz, she'd called him. Would he lead Matthias out of this nightmare, or just drag him into another kind of hell? Choose, Helvar. Matthias clasped the boy's hand. If this was real and not illusion, he'd escape whatever trap these creatures had set for him. He heard Nina release a long breath. Was she relieved? Exasperated? He shook his head. He would deal with her later. The little bronze girl swept a cloak around Matthias's shoulders and propped an ugly, beak-nosed mask on his head. The passageway outside the cell was chaos. Costumed men and women surged past, screaming and pushing each other, trying to get away from the arena. Guards had their guns out, and he could hear shots being fired. He felt dizzy, and his side ached badly. His left arm was still useless. Kaz signaled toward the far right archway, indicating that they should move against the flow of the crowd and into the arena. Matthias didn't care. He could plunge through the mob instead, force his way up that staircase and onto a boat. And then what? It didn't matter. There was no time for planning. He stepped into the throng and was instantly hauled back.
Boys like you weren't meant to get ideas, Halvar, said Kaz. That staircase leads to a bottleneck. You think the guards won't check under that mask before they let you through?
Matthias scowled and followed the others through the crowd, Kaz's hand at his back. If the passage had been chaos, then the arena was a special kind of madness. Matthias glimpsed hyenas leaping and bounding over the ledges. One was feeding over a body in a crimson cape. An elephant charged the wall of the stadium, sending up a cloud of dust and bellowing its frustration. He saw a white bear and one of the great jungle cats from the southern colonies crouching in the eaves, its teeth bared. He knew there were snakes in the cages as well. He could only hope that this Jesper character hadn't been foolish enough to set them free too. They plunged across the sands where Matthias had fought for privileges for the last 6 months, but as they headed toward the tunnel, the desert lizard came pounding toward them, its mouth dripping, foaming white poison, its fat tail lashing the ground. Before Matthias could think to move, the bronze girl had vaulted over its back and dispatched the creature with two bright daggers wedged beneath the armor of its scales. The lizard groaned and collapsed on its side. Matthias felt a pang of sadness. It was a grotesque creature, and he'd never seen a fighter survive its attack, but it was also a living thing. You've never seen a fighter survive until now, he corrected himself. The bronze girl's daggers merit watching. He'd assumed they'd cross the arena and head back up into the stands to avoid the crowds clogging the passageway, possibly just storm the stairs and hope to make it through the guards who must be waiting at the top. Instead, Kaz led them down the tunnel past the cages. The cages were old cells that had been turned over to whatever beasts the masters of the Hell Show had gotten their hands on that week. Old circus animals, even diseased livestock in a pinch, creatures culled from forest and countryside. As they raced past the open doors, he glimpsed a pair of yellow eyes glaring at him from the shadows, and then he was moving on. He cursed his deadened arm and lack of weapon. He was virtually defenseless. Where is this Kaz leading us? They wended past a wild boar feeding on a guard and a spotted cat that hissed and spit at them, but did not draw near. And then, through the musk of animals and the stink of their waste, he smelled the clean tang of salt water. He heard the rush of waves. He slipped and discovered the stones beneath his feet were damp. He was deeper in the tunnel than he'd ever been permitted to go. It must lead to the sea. Whatever Nina and her people intended, they really were taking him out of the bowels of Hellgate. In the green light from the orbs carried by Kaz and the bronze girl, he spotted a tiny boat moored up ahead. It looked like a guard was seated in it, but he raised a hand and waved them forward.
You were early, Jesper, Kaz said as he nudged Matthias toward the boat.
I was on time.
For you, that's early. Next time you plan to impress me, give me some warning.
The animals are out, and I found you a boat. This is when a thank you would be in order.
Thank you, Jesper, said Nina.
You're very welcome, gorgeous. See, Kaz, that's how the civilized folk do.
Matthias was only half listening. The fingers of his left hand had started to tingle as sensation returned. He couldn't fight all of them, not in this state, and not when they were armed. But Kaz and the boy in the boat, Jesper, looked to be the only ones with guns. Unhook the rope, disable Jesper. He'd have a gun and possession of the boat. And Nina can stop your heart before you've taken hold of the oars, he reminded himself. So shoot her first. Put a bullet in her heart. Stay long enough to watch her fall and then be done with this place. He could do it. He knew he could.
All he needed was a distraction. The bronze girl was standing just to his right. She barely reached his shoulder. Even injured, he could knock her into the water without losing his footing or doing her any real harm. Drop the girl, free the boat, disable the shooter, kill Nina, kill Nina, kill Nina. He took a deep breath and threw his weight at the bronze girl. She stepped aside as if she'd known he was coming, languidly hooking her heel behind his ankle. Matthias let out a loud grunt as he landed hard on the stones.
Matthias,
Nina said, stepping forward. He scrambled backward, nearly landing himself in the water. If she laid hands on him again, he'd lose his mind. Nina halted, the hurt on her face unmistakable. She had no right.
Clumsy, this one,
the bronze girl said impassively.
Put him under, Nina, commanded Kaz. Don't!
Matthias protested, panic surging through him.
You're dumb enough to capsize the boat. Stay away from me, witch,
Matthias growled at Nina. Nina gave him a tight nod.
With pleasure.
She lifted her hands, and Matthias felt his eyelids grow heavy as she dragged him into unconsciousness.
Kill you, he mumbled.
Sleep well.
Her voice was a wolf, dogging his steps. It chased him into the dark. In a windowless room draped in black and crimson, Matthias listened silently to the strange words coming out of the pale, freakish boy's mouth. Matthias knew monsters, and one glance at Kaz Brekker had told him this was a creature who had spent too long in the dark. He'd brought something back with him when he'd crawled into the light. Matthias could sense it around him. He knew others laughed at Fjärden's superstition, but he trusted his gut. Or he had, until Nina. That had been one of the worst effects of her betrayal, the way he'd been forced to second-guess himself. That doubt had almost been his undoing at Hellgate, where instinct was everything. He'd heard Brekker's name in prison, and the words associated with him, criminal prodigy, ruthless, amoral. They called him Dirty Hands because there was no sin he would not commit for the right price. And now this demon was talking about breaking into the ice court, about getting Matthias to commit treason. Again, Matthias corrected himself. I'd be committing treason again. He kept his eyes on Brekker. He was keenly aware of Nina watching him from the other side of the room. He could still smell her rose perfume in his nose and even in his mouth. The sharp flower scent rested against his tongue, as if he were tasting her. Matthias had woken, bound and tied to a chair in what looked like some kind of gambling parlor. Nina must have brought him out of the stupor she'd placed him in. She was there, along with the bronze girl. Jesper, the long-limbed boy from the boat, sat in a corner with his bony knees drawn up, and a boy with ruddy gold curls doodled aimlessly on a scrap of paper atop a round table made for playing cards, occasionally gnawing on his thumb. The table was covered with a crimson cloth, flocked with a repeating pattern of crows, and a wheel similar to the one used in the Hell Show arena but with different markings had been propped against a black lacquered wall. Matthias had the feeling that someone, probably Nina, had tended to more of his injuries while he was unconscious. The thought made him sick. Better clean pain than Grisha corruption. Then Brekker had started talking. About a drug called Jurta Parum, about an impossibly high reward, and about the absurd idea of attempting a raid on the ice court. Matthias wasn't sure what might be fact or fiction, but it hardly mattered. When Brekker finally finished, Matthias simply said, no.
Believe me when I say this, Helvar. I know getting knocked out and waking up in strange surroundings isn't the friendliest way to start a partnership, but you didn't give us many options, so try to open your mind to the possibilities. You could have come to me on your knees and my answer would be the same. You do understand I can have you back at Hellgate in a matter of hours? Once poor Muzzin is in the infirmary, the switch will be easy. Do it. I can't wait to tell the warden your ridiculous plans. What makes you think you'll be going back with a tongue?
Kaz,
Nina protested.
Do what you want.
Matthias said. He wouldn't betray his country again.
I told you,
said Nina.
Don't pretend to know me, witch, he snarled, his eyes trained on Brecker. He wouldn't look at her. He refused to. Jesper unfolded himself from the corner. Now that they were out of the Hellgate gloom, Matthias could see he had deep brown, zemony skin and incongruous gray eyes. He was built like a stork. Without him, there's no job, said Jesper. We can't break into the ice court blind. Matthias wanted to laugh. You can't break into the ice court at all. The ice court wasn't an ordinary building. It was a compound, Fierda's ancient stronghold, home to an unbroken succession of kings and queens, repository of their greatest treasures and most sacred religious relics. It was impenetrable. Come now, Helvar, said the demon. Surely there's something you want. The cause is righteous enough for a zealot like you. Fierda may think they've caught a dragon by the tail, but they won't be able to hold on. Once Bol-Yul Bayur replicates his process, Gerda Parum will enter the market, and it's only a matter of time before others learn to manufacture it too. It will never happen. Yul Bayur will stand trial, and if he is found guilty, he will be put to death.
Guilty of what? Nina asked softly.
Crimes against the people.
Which people?
He could hear the barely leashed anger in her voice.
Natural people, Matthias replied. People who live in harmony with the laws of this world instead of twisting them for their own gain.
Nina made a kind of exasperated snorting sound. The others just looked amused, smirking at the poor, backward Fjerdin. Brum had warned Matthias that the world was full of liars, pleasure seekers, faithless heathens, and there seemed to be a concentration of them in this room.
You're being short-sighted about this, Helvar, said Brecker. Another team could get to Yul Bayur first, the Shu, maybe the Ravkins, all with their own agendas. Border disputes and old rivalries don't matter to the Kirch. All the Merchant Council cares about is trade, and they want to make sure Gerda Parum remains a rumor and nothing more.
So leading criminals into the heart of Fjerda to steal a valued prisoner is a patriotic act? Matthias said scornfully.
I don't suppose the promise of 4 million Kruga will sway you either, Matthias spat. You can keep your money. Choke on it.
Then a thought came to him, vile, barbaric, but the one thing that might allow him to return to Hellgate with peace in his heart, even if he didn't have a tongue in his head. He tilted back as far as his bonds would permit and focused all his attention on Brecker.
I'll make a deal with you.
I'm listening.
I won't go with you, but I'll give you a plan for the layout of the court. That should at least get you past the first checkpoint.
And what will this valuable information cost me?
I don't want your money. I'll give you the plans for nothing.
It shamed Matthias to say the words, but he spoke them anyway. If you let me kill Nina Zenik. The little bronze girl made a sound of disgust, her contempt for him clear, and the boy at the table stopped doodling, his mouth falling open. Kaz, however, didn't seem surprised. If anything, he looked pleased. Matthias had the uncomfortable sense that the demon had known exactly how this would play out.
I can give you something better, said Kaz.
What could be better than revenge?
There's nothing else I want.
I can make you a Druskela again.
Are you a magician, then? A wage sprite who grants wishes? I'm superstitious, not stupid.
You can be both, you know, but that's hardly the point.
Kaz slipped a hand into his dark coat.
Here,
he said, and gave a piece of paper to the bronze girl, another demon. This one walked with soft feet like she drifted in from the next world, and no one had the good sense to send her back. She brought the paper up to his face for him to read. The document was written in Kirch and Fjerdin. He couldn't read Kirch. He'd only picked up the language in prison. But the Fjerdin was clear enough. And as his eyes moved over the page, Matthias' heart started to pound. In light of new evidence, Matthias Benedict Helvar is granted full and immediate pardon for all charges of slave trafficking. He is released on this day, blank, with the apologies of the court and will be provided transport to his homeland or a destination of his choosing, with all possible haste and the sincere apologies of this court and the Kirch government. What new evidence? Kaz leaned back in his chair.
It seems Nina Zenick has recanted her statements. She will face charges of perjury.
Now he did look at her. He couldn't stop it. He left bruises on her graceful throat. He told himself to be glad of it.
Perjury? How long will you serve for that, Zenick?
2 months, she said quietly.
2 months?
Now he did laugh, long and hard. His body twitched with it, as if it were a poison constricting his muscles. The others watched him with some concern.
Just how crazy is he?
Asked Jesper, fingers drumming on the pearl handles of his revolvers. Brecker shrugged.
He's not what I'd call reliable, but he's all we've got.
2 months, probably in some cozy prison where she'd charm every guard into bringing her fresh bread and fluffing her pillows. Or maybe she'd just talk them into letting her pay a fine that her rich Grisha keepers back in Ravka could cover for her.
She can't be trusted, you know, he said to Brecker. Whatever secrets you hope to gain from Bo Yulbayur, she'll turn them over to Ravka. Let me worry about that, Helvar. You do your part, and the secrets of Yulbayur and Jurta Parum will be in the hands of the people best equipped to make sure they stay rumors.
2 months. Nina would serve her time and return to Ravka 4 million Kruga richer, never giving him another thought. But if this pardon was real, then he could go home too.
Home.
He'd imagined breaking out of Hellgate plenty of times, but he'd never really put his mind to the idea of escape. What life was there for him on the outside, with the charge of slaver hanging around his neck? He could never return to Fjerda. Even if he could have borne the disgrace, he'd have lived each day as a fugitive from the Kirch government, a marked man. He knew he could eke out a life for himself in Novia Zem, but what would have been the point? This was something different. If the demon Brecker spoke the truth, Matthias would get to go home. The longing for it twisted in his chest, to hear his language spoken, to see his friends again, taste semla filled with sweet almond paste, feel the bite of the northern wind as it came roaring over the ice, to return home and be welcomed there without the burden of dishonor. With his name cleared, he could return to his life as a Druskella. And the price would be treason.
What if Bo Yulbayur is dead? He asked Brecker. Van Eck insists he isn't.
But how could the merchant Kaz spoke of truly understand Fjerdan ways? If there hadn't been a trial yet, there would be, and Matthias could easily predict the outcome. His people would never free a man with such terrible knowledge.
But what if he is, Brecker? You still get your pardon.
Even if their quarry was already on his way to the afterlife, Matthias would have his freedom. At what cost, though? He'd made mistakes before. He'd been foolish enough to trust Nina. He'd been weak, and he would carry that shame for the rest of his life. But he'd paid for his stupidity in blood and misery and the stink of Hellgate. And his crimes had been meager things, the actions of a naive boy. This was so much worse, to reveal the secrets of the Ice Court, to see his homeland once more only to know that every step he took, there was an act of treason. Could he do such a thing? Brum would have laughed in their faces, torn that pardon to pieces, but Kaz Brecker was smart. He clearly had resources. What if Matthias said no, and against all odds Brecker and his crew still found their way into the Ice Court and stole the shoe scientist? Or what if Brecker was right and another country got there first? It sounded like Parum was too addictive to be useful to Grisha, but what if the formula fell into Ravkan hands, and they somehow managed to adapt it, to make Ravka's Grisha, its second army, even stronger? If he was part of this mission, Matthias could make sure Bo Yulbayur never took another breath outside the Ice Court's walls, or he could arrange for some kind of accident on the trip back to Kirch. Before Nina, before Hellgate, he never would have considered it. Now he found he could make this bargain with himself. He would join the demon's crew, earn his pardon, and when he was a Druskella once more, Nina Zenik would be his first target. He'd hunt her in Kerch, in Ravka, whatever hole or corner of the world she thought would keep her safe. He would run Nina Zenik to ground and make her pay in every way imaginable. Death would be too good. He'd have her thrown into the most miserable cell in the ice court, where she'd never be warm again. He'd toy with her as she'd toyed with him. He'd offer her salvation and then deny it. He'd gift her with affection and small kindnesses, then snatch them away. He would savor every tear she shed and replace that sweet green flower scent with the salt of her sorrow on his tongue. Even so, the words were bitter in Matthias' mouth when he said, "I'll do it." Brekker winked at Nina, and Matthias wanted to knock his teeth in. "When I've dealt Nina her life's share of misery, I'll come for you." He'd caught witches. How different could it be to slay a demon? The bronze girl folded up the document and handed it to Brekker, who slipped it into his breast pocket. Matthias felt like he was watching an old friend, one he'd never hoped to see again, vanish into a crowd, and he was powerless to call out.
"We're going to untie you," said Brekker. "I hope prison hasn't robbed you of all your manners or good sense."
Matthias nodded, and the bronze girl took a knife to the ropes binding him.
"I believe you know, Nina," Brekker continued. "The lovely girl freeing you is Inej, our thief of secrets and the best in the trade. Jesper Fahey is our sharpshooter, Zemini-born, but try not to hold that against him. And this is Wylan, best demolitions expert in the barrel."
"Rask is better," Inej said.
The boy looked up, ruddy gold hair flopping in his eyes, and spoke for the first time.
"He's not better. He's reckless."
"He knows his trade."
"So do I."
"Barely," Jesper said.
"Wylan is new to the scene," admitted Brekker.
"Of course he's new. He looks like he's about 12, retorted Matthias.
"I'm 16, said Wylan sullenly.
Matthias doubted that, 15 at most. The boy didn't even look like he'd started shaving. In fact, at 18, Matthias suspected that he was the oldest of the bunch. Brekker's eyes were ancient, but he couldn't be any older than Matthias. For the first time, Matthias really looked at the people around him. What kind of team is this for a mission so perilous? Treason wouldn't be an issue if they were all dead, and only he knew exactly how treacherous this endeavor might prove.
"We should be using Rask," Jesper said. "He's good under pressure."
"I don't like it," agreed Inej.
"I didn't ask," said Kaz. "Besides, Wylan isn't just good with the flint and fuss. He's our insurance."
"Against what?"
asked Nina.
"Meet Wylan Van Neck,"
said Kaz Brekker as the boy's cheeks flooded crimson.
"Jan Van Neck's son and our guarantee on 30 million Kruga."
8. Jesper. Jesper stared at Wylan. "Of course you're a councilman's kid," he burst out laughing. "That explains everything." He knew he should be angry at Kaz for holding back yet another vital piece of information, but right now, he was just enjoying watching the little revelation of Wylan Van Eck's identity go careening around the room like an ornery colt kicking up dust. Wylan was red-faced and mortified. Nina looked stunned and irritated. The Fjärden just seemed confused. Kaz appeared utterly pleased with himself, and of course, Inej didn't look remotely surprised. She gathered Kaz's secrets and kept them as well. Jesper tried to ignore the pang of jealousy he felt at that. Wylan's mouth opened and closed, his throat working. "You knew?" he asked Kaz miserably. Kaz leaned back in his chair, one knee bent, his bad leg stretched out before him. "Why do you think I've been keeping you around?" I'm good at demo. You're passable at demo. You're excellent at hostage. That was cruel, but that was Kaz. And the barrel was a far rougher teacher than Kaz could ever be. At least, this explained why Kaz had been coddling Wylan and sending jobs his way. It doesn't matter, said Jesper. We should still take Rask and leave this baby merch on lockdown in Ketterdom. I don't trust Rask. And you trust Wylan Van Eck, Jesper said incredulously. Wylan doesn't know enough people to cause us real trouble. Don't I have some say in this? Complained Wylan. I'm sitting right here. Kaz raised a brow. Ever had your pocket picked, Wylan? Not that I know of. Been mugged in an alley? No. Hung over the side of a bridge with your head in the canal? Wylan blinked. No, but ever been beaten until you can't walk? No. Why do you think that is? It's been 3 months since you left your daddy's mansion on the Geldstraat. Why do you suppose your sojourn in the barrel has been so blessed? Lucky, I guess, Wylan suggested weakly. Jesper snorted. Kaz is your luck, Merchling. He's had you under Dreg's protection. Though you're so useless, up until this minute, none of us could figure out why. It was perplexing, Nina admitted. Kaz always has his reasons, murmured Inej. Why did you move out of your father's house? Jesper asked. It was time, Wylan said tightly. Idealist? Romantic? Revolutionary? Idiot, suggested Nina. No one chooses to live in the barrel if he has another option. I'm not useless, Wylan said. Rask is the better demo man, Inej began. I've been to the ice court with my father. We went to an embassy dinner. I can help with the plans. See that? Hidden depths. Kaz tapped his gloved fingers over the crow's head of his cane. And I don't want our only leverage against Van Eck cooling his heels in Ketterdom while we head north. Wylan goes with us. He's good enough at demo, and he's got a fine hand for sketching, thanks to all those pricey tutors. Wylan blushed deeper, and Jesper shook his head. Play piano, too. Flute, said Wylan defensively. Perfect. And since Wylan has seen the ice court with his very own eyes, Kaz continued, he can help keep you honest, Helvar. The Fjerdin scowled furiously, and Wylan looked a little ill. Don't worry, Nina said. The glower isn't lethal. Jesper noted the way Matthias's shoulders bunched every time Nina talked. He didn't know what history they were chewing on, but they'd probably kill each other before they ever got to Fjerda. Jesper rubbed his eyes. He was low on sleep and exhausted after the excitement of the prison break, and now his thoughts were buzzing and jumping at the possibility of 30 million Kruger. Even after Per Haskell got his 20%, that would leave 4 million for each of them. What could he do with a pile of scratch that big? Jesper could just imagine his father saying, "Land yourself in a pile of shit twice as big." Saints. He missed him. Kaz tapped his cane on the polished wood floor. Take out your pen and proper paper, Wylan. Let's put Helvar to work. Wylan reached into the satchel at his feet and pulled out a slender roll of butcher's paper, followed by a metal case that held an expensive-looking pen and ink set. How nice, Jesper noted. A nib for every occasion. Start talking, Kaz said to the Fjerdin. It's time to pay the rent. Matthias directed his furious gaze at Kaz, definitely a mighty glower. It was almost fun to watch him pit it against Kaz's shark-like stare. Finally, the Fjerdin shut his eyes, took a deep breath, and said, The ice court is on a bluff overlooking the harbor at Jerholm. It's built in concentric circles like the rings of a tree. The words came slowly, as if speaking each one was causing him pain. First, the ring wall, then the outer circle. It's divided into three sectors. Beyond that is the ice moat. Then, at the center of everything, the White Island. Wyland began to sketch. Jesper peered over Wyland's shoulder. That doesn't look like a tree. It looks like a cake. Well, it is sort of like a cake, Wyland said defensively. The whole thing is built on a rise. Kaz gestured for Matthias to continue. The cliffs are unscalable, and the northern road is the only way in or out. You'll have to get through a guarded checkpoint before you even reach the ring wall. Two checkpoints, said Wyland. When I was there, there were two. There you have it, Kaz said to Jesper. Marketable skills. Wyland is watching you, Helvar. Why two checkpoints? Inej asked. Matthias stared at the black walnut slats of the floor and said, It's harder to bribe two sets of guards. The security at the court is always built with multiple fail-safes, if you make it that far. We, Helvar, if we make it that far, corrected Kaz. The Fjärden gave the barest shrug. If we make it that far. The outer circle is split into three sectors, the prison, the Druskala facilities, and the embassy, each with its own gate in the ring wall. The prison gate is always functioning, but it's kept under constant armed surveillance. Of the two others, only one is ever operational at any given time. What determines which gate is used? Asked Jesper. The schedule changes each week, and guards are only given their postings the night before. Maybe that's a good thing, said Jesper. If we can figure out which gate isn't running, it won't be manned or guarded. There are always at least four guards on duty, even when the gate isn't in use. Pretty sure we can handle four guards. Matthias shook his head. The gates weigh thousands of pounds and can only be operated from within the guardhouses. And even if you could raise one of them, opening a gate that isn't scheduled for use would trigger black protocol. The entire court would go on lockdown and you'd give away your location. A ripple of unease passed through the room. Jesper shifted uncomfortably. If the expressions on the others' faces were any indication, they were all having the same thought. Just what are we getting into? Only Kaz seemed unfazed. Put it all down, Kaz said, tapping the paper. Helvar, I expect you to describe the mechanics of the alarm system to Wyland later. Matthias frowned. I don't really know how it works. It's some kind of series of cables and bells. Tell him all you know. Where will they be keeping Beaujolbeur? Slowly, Matthias rose and approached the plans taking shape beneath Wyland's pen. His movements were reluctant, as wary as if Kaz had told him to pet a rattler. Probably here, the Fjärden said, resting his finger on the paper. The prison sector. The high-security cells are on the topmost floor. It's where they keep the most dangerous criminals. Assassins. Terrorists. Grisha? Nina asked. Exactly, he replied grimly. You guys are going to make this really fun, aren't you? Asked Jesper. Usually, people don't start hating each other until a week into the job, but you two have a head start. They cast him twin glares, and Jesper beamed back at them. But Kaz's attention was focused on the plans. Beaujolbeur isn't dangerous, he said thoughtfully. At least, not in that way. I don't think they'll keep him locked up with the rabble. I think they'll keep him in a grave, said Matthias. Operate on the assumption that he isn't dead. He's a valued prisoner, one they don't want falling into the wrong hands before he stands trial. Where would he be? Matthias looked at the plan. The buildings of the outer circle surround the ice moat, and at the moat's center is the White Island, where the treasury and the royal palace are. It's the most secure place in the ice court. Then that's where Beaulieu-Bayeur will be, said Kaz. Matthias smiled. Actually, it was less a smile than a baring of teeth. He learned that grin at Hellgate, thought Jesper. Then your quest is pointless, Matthias said. There is no way a group of foreigners is going to make it to the White Island. Don't look so pleased, Helvar. We don't get inside. You don't get your pardon. Matthias shrugged. I can't change what is true. The ice moat is watched from multiple guard towers on the White Island and a lookout atop the Elder Clock. It's completely uncrossable except by way of the glass bridge, and there's no way onto the glass bridge without clearance. Hringkala is coming, Nina said. Be silent, Matthias snapped at her. Pray, don't, said Kaz. Hringkala. It's the day of listening, when the new Druskala are initiated on the White Island. Matthias's knuckles flexed white. You have no right to speak of those things. They're holy. They're facts. The Fjerdan royals throw a huge party with guests from all over the world, and plenty of the entertainment comes straight from Ketterdam.